This is Chuck Hickman.
Now from Quizzic, formerly University of Access, the academic vice president, and I'll turn it over to Chuck.
Thanks, Bob. Well, good morning. Speakers, you know, always tell you about how happy they are to be wherever it is they are, and I will tell you that too. I'm really glad, though, that Bob did that little poll in the beginning about how many faculty and how many deans were in here, because having worked for ACSB for 20 years, you can imagine that I've spent a lot of time with deans, and you learn when you work for the Dean's Association to treat deans with reverence, or at least respect. And from time to time, you hear deans talk with, sometimes with frustration of members. And sometimes you think that's really how the world is. And I learned differently one day when I was visiting the campus. And it's been me talking with faculty members. I excused myself right before we went to lunch and went to the restroom. And in the faculty wing of the building, and there was one of those forced air dryers that they have there to help clean your hands. And somebody had scratched on the enamel around the button on that dryer, "Push here to receive message from the dean." And so after that, I also learned to approach faculty audiences with a certain measure of extra respect, too. I'll try to do that this morning, and I guess the other thing to say right off the top is 8:30 to 4:30 is a long, long time, and all of us on the program I know will advocate good learning methodology. We'll try to practice it, too, and in this case, it can't be much fun for all of you just to sit and listen between now and 4:30. So if you've got questions, comments, just wave at me and we'll try to stop and handle them. Let me begin by just trying to embellish a little bit more on some things Bob said. He set the stage pretty well. But distance learning, online learning will matter in our industry. And if you doubt that for even a minute, let me tell you why I've come to that conclusion. In the United States alone, employers with more than 100 employees spend $65 billion a year on education and training. My reckoning, about not quite a third of that is spent on, here's an executive's, the university-based business school piece of that market is somewhere between $5 and $10 billion. So there's a lot of room for growth. In 1998, Merrill Lynch reports that about $3 billion of that total was spent on technology-mediated or delivered learning. Fairly small proportion. Merrill Lynch says, though, that by 2001, just next year, $8.2 billion of that total will be devoted to delivery of courses and training via distance. And the projections beyond 2001, although they're hard to make for a series of reasons that I suppose are obvious to this group, clearly suggest that the growth in our industry will be in this kind of venture. Worldwide, demand for management education is growing at unprecedented levels, particularly in emerging or transitional economies. By our reckoning, 37 million managers in the world have access to the internet and speak English. And so when you hear from me or our UNext friends or any of the other kinds of organizations you saw on Bob's chart, that's the potential market. So it's no wonder the venture capital is flowing into the kinds of e-learning companies Bob mentioned, but also even into the kinds of universities and university-based business schools try to tap that market. In the United States, back home for a minute, there are now more students 35 years of age and older enrolled in degree programs in our institutions than there are 19-year-olds and under. That's a number that's much easier to project out over the next few years because all of those people, of course, are walking around. They're in existence now. Our student body will get older, it will become more experienced, and clearly those students are strongly aligned to business and management topics. They also define value differently to the kinds of 18 to 21-year-old students, or even mid-20-year-old students, mid-20s students that we are accustomed to serving. And clearly, quality to them will be defined in terms of things like easy access and return on financial investment. If you start to think about that, that changes some of the strategies that all of us, all of you, need to think about meet that market. One of the other things that many of you have probably noticed also is that the faculty shortage that we started monitoring at AACSB, 20 years ago, is starting to come back. There are at least a few people, as I look around the room, who look old enough to remember the early 80s. When 20% of the authorized tenure track positions in business schools were vacant, and there were about, on average, 4.5 openings for each new graduate of the doctoral program. Accounting was one of the disciplines where the shortage was particularly high. By the late 80s, by the early 90s, that vacancy rate for U.S. business schools was down to about 5%. But guess what? It started back up again. ACSB, some of you may have seen, reported that the vacancy rate during the 1999-2000 year is now back up to 6.7%, and in some disciplines, MIS most dramatically, is considerably higher. Right now, 14% of authorized tenure track positions in MIS are vacant. In accounting, it's around 8%. And if you look at the production of doctoral programs, which has been declining slightly throughout the 1990s, you know that the supply of new faculty meet the demands, the student and corporate demands I mentioned a minute ago, let alone the replacement rate. A third of all faculty in business schools are now 55 years old, older. It's going to be a challenge. What does that mean? Well, for one, university-based business schools have to find new and creative ways to leverage their intellectual property in ways that they have not done before. If you are focused on on-campus programs only, if you are focused only on degree certificate programs, you have chosen to take the most mature part of our industry and place all your bets there, because the growth is not going to be on our campuses. It's not going to be with 18 to 21-year-olds. This is, to a large degree, it's not going to be generated by students in the United States. And that has a lot of strategic implications for each of your institutions. There are a lot of things that we could start by starting discussing online or distance learning. Bob has already given you a program outline for the day. I won't try to tackle all of them here, but let me try to at least put two or three out on the table now. And I am going to save time so that we have a chance to talk about them before the break. One of them is branding. and Bob mentioned that too. The magazine rankings, we've probably grown accustomed to living with Business Week and U.S. News. Financial Times just came out with one. I suppose most of you have seen the Wall Street Journal is going to do one this year. Forbes is out there. Suggests that, like it or not, the service we provide is now viewed as a commodity. And that many of the new customers, the kinds of people that I mentioned a minute ago, are not shopping this industry with great existing knowledge of our institutions or of the ways that you and I might compare and contrast the characteristics of programs at different schools. They don't know those things. And that means they will often be buying a brand. Thinking back to long ago to when I was taking marketing courses, branding means building a distinctive, sustainable, and hard to replace identity product. For business schools, university-based business schools, that may be a subject matter specialization, and you can all think of examples of, say, entrepreneurship. Everybody will think of Babson. You say management technology, you might say Rensselaer, and so on. A method of teaching, you could all think of schools that specialize in the case method or have worked hard at developing clinical learning experiences. Others that use a very quantitative approach. Others that are much more behavioral focused. Some schools focus on particular kinds of students. Others have built a brand because of their research excellence. I don't know where each of your schools falls in that continuum, but no matter where you are, you don't have a geographic franchise anymore. It's gone. And so the franchise that you have or need to develop, the brand, has to be centered around a lot of those other kinds of characteristics. Now, business schools are not all sleeping on the job with respect to brand. Many of you probably have stories to tell. Last fall, I moved from St. Louis to Los Angeles, and so my drive time is a lot longer than it used to be. And depending on what radio station I want to listen to in the morning, you can hear radio advertisements, of course, for seven or eight different schools. I mean, you've got the highbrow schools that sponsor Morning Edition on NPR, but if you go over to even Howard Stern, you can find business school advertisements during the breaks. I read recently about one school that was pretty happy because they had arranged a deal with the newspaper in their community to brand the little wrappers that cover your newspapers in the morning, that they throw into your yard. Those wrappers now say, go have an MBA ad. So there's more, branding is more sophisticated in some places than others. But clearly, in the time I've been in this field, that this is not a conversation we would have had 20 years ago, even 10. It's a big deal now. For now, to bring this back to e-learning, for now, university-based business schools still hold the brand. Not e-learning companies, not individual faculty members. At least not within management education. UNext, Quizzic, Pensara, several of the companies that Bob mentioned in his introduction, are all seeking and trying to make alliances with major schools suggested in part to benefit from that brand and to obtain credibility for their own products and services. For schools that want to deliver their own online degree programs, building and sustaining brands in the crowded e-learning space, not only because of all the other competitors, but because of the geographic reach of these kinds, potential geographic reach of these kinds of programs, is very difficult. Harvard has a brand, Duke has a brand, Columbia has a brand. But the number of schools that I can name around the world that, if they master kind of all the technological issues and internal kinds of problems to deliver it, to market successfully, to sell their degree or executive program worldwide, are pretty limited. It's expensive, it's difficult. Some of you may be familiar with Jag Sheff, the marketing faculty member who's been at several different schools, Illinois, Pitt, Southern Cal. He's at Emory now. He's done a lot of writing, not only in the scholarly, but also in popular press, about the rule of three. Jag's rule of three is that in a large industry, basically in the end, you're going to get three comprehensive brands. Market can't sustain any more. Well, that's an issue then. Are we in industry headed towards three major brands and then a lot of niche players? I can't answer that question for you right now. But if you think about other industries, particularly ones that have become fairly mature, it's hard to find too many examples where Jag's theory is wrong. For business schools without a built-in brand or the resources to build one, Bob's also suggested to us one of the strategies that's particularly relevant, and that is creating alliances and partnerships to combine resources. He mentioned the Haas, Michigan, Darden Alliance, that at the moment is simply pulling intellectual property from those three schools and they're exchanging it among themselves. They don't plan to market it outside yet, but it's hard for me to imagine a situation where they might. London Business School and Columbia are now combining on a distance learning-based executive MBA program. The Jesuit schools, there are, I think, more than 30 Jesuit-affiliated schools just in the United States and a number scattered around the world, now offer a MBA program, not distance-based, in China. Some of you may have read in the Chronicle that those Jesuit schools at the undergraduate level are starting to combine and put courses online. That's another example of a partnership, a logical partnership. A number of the branded undergraduate liberal arts colleges in the East Coast are also working right now to create an alliance and partnership to do that. All of you can think of other alliances or partnerships that make sense. What if you could get these schools in the Big Ten Athletic Conference to combine to deliver an MBA program? They'd certainly have the biggest alumni base in the world to start with to market their program. What if your business school didn't have a brand, but if you wanted to get into the online learning business, say with healthcare managers or physicians, wouldn't it make sense to try to approach the Cleveland Clinic or Johns Hopkins or the Mayo Clinic or somebody else that is branded in the market you are trying to serve and leverage that brand? That's the kind of strategy, that's the kind of thinking that's in this industry now. And deans, schools, that aren't engaged in it are likely to be losers in a kind of competition that Bob has described to you. The competition is based in several different levels, and I'm guessing that no matter what school you're located at, you've seen some of this already. A partial list, it's almost impossible to keep track of this, of schools that are offering MBA programs either entirely or at least largely online right now in the United States, includes some good bad brand names. Bob mentioned Duke. He could have mentioned Indiana. He could have mentioned Purdue. As well, Syracuse, Auburn, as well as a lot of local and regional players, Baltimore, Missouri St. Louis, Wisconsin Whitewater, Ohio University, Drexel here in Philadelphia, Cal State Dominguez Hills. A lot of the schools that came into this market first were in fact those local and regional institutions trying to get a first mover advantage. Can they keep it? Maybe. Maybe not. But at least they're smart enough to recognize they have to play the game. Bob also mentioned some less conventional rivals. University of Phoenix offers an online MBA program. Kaplan, I don't know if it's up and running yet, but they're on the way if they're not. They've already been running an online law school. Our Cardian friends, I'll let them talk about Cardian and you next. But by all accounts, are headed towards offering their brand of MBA program using the intellectual content of the schools that Bob described. That's not all the competition. There are still others like Open University, the school that's been in the online business for close to 30 years in the UK, that recently achieved regional accreditation here in the US as a precursor to offering an online MBA program here. And National Technological University, which many of you who know the engineering education community are familiar with. They've been offering engineering degrees at distance for, at least two decades, are getting ready to move into the MBA business too. So those kinds of numbers I mentioned in the beginning about the size of our market are attracting lots and lots of players. In executive education, the Fuqua School has announced plans to create a for-profit subsidiary in which they will sell stock publicly to deliver custom executive education and to repackage and then to repackage those courses, those modules, for distribution to others who want to buy a license to use it. Wharton and IBM announced an alliance this spring to provide online learning events about e-commerce. This program will include customized content and collaborative communities among people that are interested in e-commerce. And clearly for the Wharton School, that's just one of many initiatives that follow, I guess most notably Wharton Direct, as experiments, finding out what kinds of things the school can do well, how it fits with their mission, what kinds of marketing tactics work, where the potential markets might be. You may have noticed that another e-learning company, Financial Times Knowledge, which is a subsidiary of Financial Times, which is a subsidiary of Pearson's, recently acquired the Forum Group, which is one of the oldest, biggest, and best-known executive education corporations. Again, with the intention of delivering more executive education, non-degree management education, online. And then, of course, there are e-learning companies. UNEX, Quizzic, Kansara, Ninth House, Cognitive Arts, all of whom are six that I can name that are particularly focused on management education. If I was suggesting a short list of e-learning companies for you to watch, those are the ones I think would be on the top of my list. And they each have a strategy. You'll hear a couple of them today to compete in this market. Ninth House, for instance, which is based in San Francisco, has acquired rights to or intellectual property from people like Tom Peters and Stephen Covey and some of the other gurus who have particular identity or branding of their own in the general public or at least in the corporate community. And that's their specialty. And then Bob, one other thing that I think for those of you who intend to follow our industry is really important, and that is these knowledge portals. He mentioned the Fathom Alliance, which is very ambitious. It's brand new. Mike may be able to say a little bit more about it when he's up here, but having signed agreements with all those great cultural institutions, now the process of getting them to work together and actually producing a product will not be a small one, but closer to home. How many of you have looked either at Knowledge at Wharton website or Working Knowledge that Harvard Business School puts out? Anybody? Okay. Do it. Both of those websites are knowledge portals. They have taken the scholarship of faculty at those two schools, put it online, and when you want just a little bit of knowledge just in time, you can go to the web. If you're going to a meeting this afternoon and need to know about supply chain management, you can go to one of those websites. Find out what Wharton or what Harvard faculty member has been studying or writing about supply chain management. Go pick out the little nugget or granule that you want, and you can kind of drill down as deeply as you want to go. See what they're reading, what their recommended bibliography is, what their scholarship has been. You can print it all out if you want to. I wonder if 10 years from now, when those magazines rate or rank business schools, if the questions they'll ask will be about the perceived quality of full-time, daytime MBA programs, or whether they'll be about the value or the utility of knowledge portals. Those knowledge portals are an example of what I mentioned is kind of my first premise for this conversation, and that is that business schools have got to find new ways to deliver what they know to all the people who want to know it. They're out there. The expectations for our constituents are very high. This is this is the centennial of graduate management education. First MBA program was created 100 years ago at Tuck School. If you were picking one moment in time to be involved in this industry, I would pick this one right now. If you believe that universities exist to serve society, business schools are going to drive a lot of the university response to the issues that matter. But we can't do that by playing a fat hand, by using the same kinds of strategies that have worked in the past. Another issue, and one that I hope you will talk about, not only throughout today, but when you go back home too, is quality. And what quality means in an online learning environment. One thing for sure is that quality will not be defined by Business School Insiders, which is another thing we're accustomed to, but instead by the kinds of constituents, by the kinds of stakeholders I mentioned. What are some of the ways that stakeholders might define quality in online programs? Well, one way for sure is the level of interactivity, not only between students and faculty, but among students. And certainly as you look at different e-learning providers or e-learning partners for your business school, you'll see some differences in the kinds of interactivity they can provide. Customization. The degree to which content is driven by and customized to the distinctive or particular needs of employer, clients, or students, and their learning styles. We had dinner last night. We were talking about the different learning styles that people at different age groups or different citizenships or who've got different levels of time, gender, race. The body of research about how people learn suggests that all those things matter. And one of the great things that the evolution of the internet has done for our industry, in my opinion, is to create a conversation that hasn't existed in business schools for a long time about pedagogy and learning methodology and how it can be improved. Other ways to judge quality. Content. Is it right? Is it current? If you, as we are right now, are trying to develop a series of courses in e-business, you better have a plan in place to update them every 2 or 3 months, because the knowledge obviously changes that fast, and that's an investment that you need to make if you're going to play in this game. Course design. Do e-learning courses or degree programs have clear learning objectives? Are they well organized? Do they have relevant materials and cases? You'll see differences as you look at the products of different companies there. Production values. Is it engaging? Does it create a compelling learning experience? Text on the web isn't going to make it, and our Unex friends and I and any of these other learning companies, e-learning companies that I mentioned, will tell you that there is at least some degree of show business in that. It's not an accident that the company I left ACSB last fall to go work for is located at the corner of Sunset and Vine in Hollywood. That gives us access to people whose business is producing TV shows, movies, and interactive video games. And like it or not, that's part of the package in trying to create a compelling learning experience. Platform support. If you're in this game, you better have it. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. You've got to keep the system up. And that's another, either an investment you have to make or dimension of a conversation you have with an e-learning firm. Student feedback. In an online environment, how will students have access to faculty? How will they know whether they're achieving their learning goals or not? Faculty training and development. E-learning companies could create the most compelling, engaging online learning experience there is, but as is the case at least in the products that Quizzic is creating, you assume that there is going to be some facilitation by faculty members at schools, the faculty members better know how to use this stuff. And if they're not happy about it, or they don't like it, or they don't know how to troubleshoot, they can undo all the time, all the investment we've made in creating these products. Student retention. How many of the students in your e-learning programs or in your competition's e-learning programs make it to the degree? How long does it take? It's another kind of metric that you ought to use. And last but not least, certification. If it's not a degree program, what kind of validation, what kind of credential can you provide to the students in the e-learning program to demonstrate that they have achieved knowledge or competency in a particular area? Hey, come at quality one other way, and that's going to lean on a lot of my roots at ACSB. At the degree level, ACSB recognizes, which is where our accreditation applies right now. ACSB is not today, as Bob mentioned, in the business of accrediting non-degree programs. Although, if they're not, they too will be choosing to restrict themselves to the most mature part of the industry, the part that's least likely to grow. If you are thinking of offering a degree program online, you do have accreditation issues to deal with. The kinds of things ACSB will look for include a clear statement of educational objectives for the online degree program, a link to of the program to institutional mission. ACSB will ask a school to show the differences in the online program from the more conventional classroom-based offerings. ACSB will expect or ask you, your school, to describe the benchmarking efforts it has undergone to compare its online program with those of other similar institutions. You'll need to show the process you have in place to get systematic feedback from stakeholders in designing your program. You need to show that you are doing the best job you can to provide clear performance expectations for students before they enroll. You probably all got competition across town that makes it sound really easy. And one of the things about online education is it really does depend on a lot of self-discipline on the part of the students. You need to show appropriate interaction online between the students and faculty and among students, complete and accurate promotional materials, systematic training, development, evaluation, and reward for faculty who are teaching in the online program. Involvement of learning design experts. When Steve and Mike come up here, I think they're going to talk about kind of the, at least in part about the development process that UNext goes through to produce the courses. And it's quite extensive. The school will need to show that the online program it's offering is congruent with the learning styles and needs of the students that it's trying to serve. You'll need to show use of learning outcome instruments. How much are the students learning this program, and how does it compare with students enrolled in more conventional programs? And that's one of the areas that all of us, schools, e-learning companies, all the people on Bob's chart have a lot of work to do yet. We've got a free pass for a little while because this is new, but to create and sustain an e-learning program over time, we've got to have answers to those questions. The school will need to have policies about intellectual property. that in a minute. And we'll need to show that a school has appropriate student support services for those enrolled in its online programs. In a period when, in an industry that's changing rapidly, as this one is, there inevitably is some pressure to use something like accreditation to restrict change or protect market share for existing institutions. I don't see ACSB headed in that direction. If that association, that organization, wants to maintain any relevance in this field, it will need to use those kinds of criteria and its standards to encourage innovation and support this kind of development instead of restrict it. Now, a little bit about Quizzic and a little bit more about the e-learning industry. And again, because you're going to hear several different speakers, they talk about it. I will try to go light on some parts and a little more detail on others. There are several kinds of e-learning firms, and Bob made one attempt to classify them in his chart. This stuff changes so quickly that it's easy not to have the most current information or to get them mixed up. There is a model that I would describe as platform companies, eCollege, WebCT, Blackboard would be examples of that. A platform company will partner with your school to put its intellectual content online. They'll work with you to do that. It is comparatively quick and inexpensive. And it's a way for you to continue to control the entire value chain of content. Those are the pluses. The minuses are certainly in the programs that we've looked at. The learning experience, the production values are not as compelling. It's not as sophisticated. The kind of money in those kinds of deals isn't there to really sink a lot into production. There is another business model, and UNext is certainly the best example of it, of a company that's paid a lot of money to acquire intellectual property from very good schools. And in the degree market, they are going to offer their own degree through Cardia. They have, Bob's right, they achieved regional accreditation from North Central recently. And then there is a different model from that, and Quizzic is an example. In our instance, we are acquiring intellectual property, not just from the individual faculty members that Bob mentioned, but also from schools, applying production values, and then selling licenses to use the resulting granules, modules, courses, programs downstream to other business schools. So if you're at Cal State Fullerton, say, and don't have a faculty member on hand to teach the supply chain management course, and there are a lot of students asking for it, this is a way for you to acquire world-class content, put your brand on it, and deliver it to your students, facilitated by one of your faculty members. Quizzic was founded 4 years ago, like most good entrepreneurial stories. It started in the garage of one of the two co-founders in Hollywood. Our goal is to combine world-class content with the very best production values that we could obtain and then sell the licenses downstream. So it is not a platform company, although we can run this stuff off our platform if our customers request it. and our customers are both university-based business schools and corporate education training units. 4 years ago, when this company started, 4 years is a long time in e-learning, this is one of the first companies out there, the brand name Graduate Business Schools, Bob, as you suggest, didn't want to talk about this. It was a little tawdry, a little suspicious. So in the beginning, the first products we developed were undergraduate courses, 13 of them now. And they were, in the beginning, video, like a combination of video and text on the web. Video is really expensive. It costs us up to $1 million to produce video in one course. Plus, it's hard to change once you've got it. So as technology has evolved, we've gotten out of the video slash web, text on web model, and now all of our courses are web only. As the broadband gets more sophisticated, you can do more things with it. If there's time, I'll show you in a minute. You can do everything you could on the video. At the undergraduate level, which is where Bob got his information, the content does come from individual faculty members, such as the ones that you mentioned. But in addition to the content, there are provided by the subject matter experts, there is streaming video of entrepreneurs and executives, particularly to try to set up a case. There are discussion boards, electronic chat rooms, computer adaptive tests, and cases. If we've got time, we'll look at a test. And then there are supplemental textbooks and course manuals. Practice. Quizzic has received 16 different awards from the U.S. Distance Learning Association, as well as from Cisco Corporation for innovation on the internet. At the graduate and corporate level, our agreements are with universities. We, for instance, have partnered with UNC Chapel Hill to develop their version of the Duke Gemba program. So we're producing all 20 courses in that program under contract with them. And once Chapel Hill has those courses, we retain the rights to break those up in little bits and pieces, repurpose them, and sell them downstream to other companies and to other schools. Some of our other institutional alliances right now are with the University of Southern California, with the Tuck School at Dartmouth, and with Rice, and there will be several more announcements about content alliances coming out in the next 6 to 8 weeks. Like Wharton, like Fathom, like Harvard, we have a portal that we are trying to build. You can find it at www.quizic.com. For us, that's a lost leader. It's not the kind of thing you charge money for. These things are tremendously expensive to operate. But it is a way to build brand, which is why Harvard and Wharton are doing it, and draw web users who are getting granules of your content into some of your other programs. Funding for Quizzic comes from companies like GE Equity, the Rockefeller family, Pearson's, Investor AB, Intel, Lake Mason, and others. For a faculty audience, it's important for me to try to articulate what kind of value I think Quizzic, or really some of the other e-learning companies too, although I'll let them speak for themselves, bring to a business school. I don't think e-learning is necessarily a threat to institutions because we are not using our brand to compete against you. We are licensing content to schools, as I mentioned, usually as a complement or a supplement to the kinds of things you are already doing in your classroom. At this point, I think classroom work still is got great value as a way to teach certain kinds of particularly skills, non-cognitive or affective kinds of things. And there's clearly a big part of the MBA market that is willing to take time and money for the kind of personal interaction that you have with other students as well as with faculty. But taking e-learning modules or courses is a terrific way, I think, for faculty members to free up time in the classroom to focus on the applications of knowledge, and then let students get the content knowledge on their own time online. This kind of product gives all business schools. Yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but we always do that anyway. We just tell the students to read the chapter in the book, and then we talk about the application. So what's the great magic of the internet?
If you do that, in my experience in 25 years of management education, you're an exception and not the rule. You know, sometimes I talk to audiences and you get into a discussion about is e-learning better or worse than more conventional.
We're going to talk about that all afternoon, especially Dan Sullivan is going to approach and compare both traditional and that. So it's coming up today.
Okay. Well, TBC. It gives all business schools an opportunity to become full-service providers, provide content in areas where you can't do it now, and in a world where branding is important, that matters. It also frees up faculty time to do other things, to focus on providing student feedback, on scholarship, on outreach, on institutional service.
Institutions don't give you a whole lot of money.
And in an era where we're going to have to find ways to create, to stretch faculty resources across a wider set of demands, that's important. Our course, just to give you a sense of how this stuff happens, the content developed by Quizzic is generally produced by a team of producers, instructional designers, writers, researchers, graphic artists in cooperation with the subject matter experts. There's usually a team of about 15 people that work on developing each course. And it takes about 3 months from the time the content is secure to when there's at least a rough cut finished product. Other faculty work on a contract basis feedback on the course structure, whether the cases, the interactive exercises are being used appropriately, so on. We work hard to make sure that every course has clear goals, lesson outlines, and expected learning outcomes. I'm gonna skip for right now the demo because we're coming up on the break, it looks like.
Pretty close.
Okay. I guess the last thing I will mention, and then we'll stop, goes back to one issue I touched on a few minutes ago. In a facilitated learning model, the skill, the knowledge, the enthusiasm of the facilitator to use this kind of product is critical, maybe the most critical element in making it work. Creating a good learning experience for students. If a school does that on its own, it needs to invest in a training and support program. If you partner with an e-learning company, one of the things you have a right to expect from that company is to find out what kinds of services, what kind of support, what kind of help they can provide you in preparing your faculty to teach in this environment. I hope I've at least raised a few more issues, helped you understand the sense of both of opportunity, but of urgency that exists in this market. Some people ask, why I left ACSB, which, if nothing else, likes to think of itself as part of the establishment. What?
No, I don't know about the rest of the audience, but I would have really liked to see some of the demo.
Demo? All right. Bob, is that all right?
Yeah, why don't you just take time?
All right, this is going to be fast, okay?
Let's go get your 15-minute break.
Okay. Let's look just at a couple of...
Take your best shot.
Well, okay. A lot of the nice things that happened is that my modem broke last night. So we're going to...
Do you need the audio speaker there? I can just plug it in.
Huh?
You want the audio?
Yes. So we're going to depend on just a couple of things that I loaded. This is a... These are undergraduate courses. Not graduate
I'm not
courses.
Sure which quarter.
All I'm going to try to do here is show one effort to create a little interaction and do it in a way that's hopefully memorable. We're talking about product life cycles and curves. And there are some different products. All right, these are all products you know. Here are hula hoops. Are they? That must be a Volkswagen. And bikinis. So, there's the lesson. I didn't want to show you all the answers. Okay, here we go. Now having learned the lesson, here's assignment. And I'm going to emphasize again, this is an introduction to marketing class. But it's asking you to drag the product to the particular product cycle. We hope that will be somewhat more memorable than some of the other way you might teach it. Here's a legal environment and business course. I'm going to skip over the streaming video from the experts. But we've got a situation where we've got an example of violence in the workplace. And here are some questions down at the bottom. You can start to give students feedback on whether they've interpreted the lesson correctly or not. If you answer the question wrong, you get that feedback and get to try again. Maybe one of the most compelling ways to use this stuff, as I mentioned, is in bringing executives case exercises into the classroom. And I'm going to leave you with a introduction to marketing course that was produced by John Quelch, who's the former Harvard faculty member, who's now dean of the London Business School. Are they hearing that?
Probably. Can you turn yours up a little more?
Are you getting any noise up there?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, not just noise. Okay, here's an example of an intro to marketing course, and broken out the lesson plans. Let's just look at lesson one. Now we're going to break down again elements or granules of each lesson. And let's look. Let's look at the Hilton Hotel case. Just to give you a. Can you hear anything?
Speakers are lousy, though, so it's your computer. Also, you're not getting the video in that projector. This stuff is a little too high resolution for this projector. He's got a video on the screen here of the guys, but it's not coming through the projector.
Well, Bob, maybe what we should do, because we're coming up to 10:30 is great, and I will keep this running up here if anybody wants to.
Just to put it in perspective, I might just say that we talk about a spectrum. You can just go to a web delivery company, and the FCT or Blackboard is a biggie. Blackboard's got the market share. But eCollege is a heavy player, well-funded in this. And they will essentially, any material you send to them, they will put online. And it's a well-managed operation, each of these three companies, but eCollege, for example, just an example, Northern Arizona has 60 courses that they put on eCollege. But it's their courses. It's really just, you're using them as a delivery. Then you go one step further, you're in the Quizzy country, where they are really providing materials under contract to your institution or your course. And you're teaching it. And you can use the materials in the way you see fit. And it's kind of the role the publishers have also been trying to compete in. So in some sense, he's got some publisher competition here. And then finally, you go up here at a higher level, and there you can turn the actual teaching of your course over to Unext, although you're still heavily involved in working with the instructors that are doing it, and so on. So you've got these different perspectives. I just want to mention one last thing in the middle here. I said the publishers have been competing. The publishers have been one disaster after another. I'm not sure just why. I'm just bottom quizzing now, but they seem to be doing quite well. They've got hard rock in some of the contract here. They're doing pretty well. I was involved with Irwin Technology when we had Penn State Cube. Irwin put in $1 million server at Penn State, and all the core courses in business were going to be with Irwin materials, some developed especially for the server, and then all the Irwin books. Accounting didn't ever buy into it, and the thing just fell flat. And so if you look at the history of the publishing ventures into this, it's been one kind of disaster after another. And some of these universities, the McGraw-Hill World University is no more, and so on. Harvard University seems to be trying to make a go of it again now. And this middle one has been a tough nut to crack. Well, we're going to come back after the break. We've got 15 minutes.